Okay, you got it?
So we'll do a little, and then we'll listen to it and see how it sounds and make sure that we're recording, and then we'll start again.
Okay.
Okay, so why don't you identify yourself and tell me who you are and what union you're in.
Okay, my name is Yvonne Mayton, and I belong to the International Union of Operating Engineers.
And what local are you in?
Local 30.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been a member of Local 30?
7 years. It'll be 7 years, actually, in August, September.
And does that include your apprenticeship period?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Don't want to stay down?
Okay. So now we'll start again.
Okay.
So how did you decide to apply for union membership or for the apprentice program?
Actually, I didn't decide to do it. You know, what happened was I was in a program in New York Technical College. They had a women's program, and it wasn't only women, but primarily women. It was called Building Maintenance and Repairs. And it was a 6-month program. And then when we got finished, they asked us each individually what we would like to do. And I said I would like to do something with my hands and with my brain. And so this was available to them, and they put me in it, and they got me in contact, put me in contact with the union people. And then I went out to the union hall out in Richmond Hill, Queens, and they sent me on an interview to a couple of places, and I got accepted into the job that I'm doing now.
So you've been at the same job?
I've been at the same job. Not the same facility, but at the same job.
So the same employer.
Right.
So then you started your formal training apprenticeship?
Right. It was a 3-year apprenticeship, and I went to... actually, the school was in the union hall itself. The union was holding its own apprenticeship out at Richmond Hill, Queens, and I did that most of the time. It was twice a week, but sometimes if we got behind, it would turn into 3, sometimes 4, especially towards the end of the apprenticeship. And the third year, we did sometimes 4 times a week. We would have to go from 6 to 9 to school after work. So I would start work most of the time at 7 o'clock in the morning. That's as a matter of fact, I did start at 7 in the morning, and I worked from 7 to 3. And then after work, I would go to school.
So I'm curious, Yvonne, about the other women who were at the technical college. Did any of them choose to go, or did they get steered towards the operating engineers?
Not that I know of. I don't remember any of the other women that went to school with me going into this trade. I know one woman in particular went into more contracting. That's what she started doing. Like working for the city, or for, not for the city actually, I think it was for some kind of agency, doing inspecting buildings, doing inspection in buildings and that kind of stuff. That's what she did. But she didn't actually go into the trades.
So were there any other women in your apprentice program with you?
Yes, there were. There was 1, 2, 3, 4. There was either 4 or 5 of us. And by the third year, there was only 2. The other three, as a matter of fact, right? The other 3 dropped out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So describe the reaction when you got on the job. What kinds of things went on in terms of...
Well, it was so funny because when I got on the job, I came into work and I had just had my brand new short haircut, you know, and I had been preparing for this kind of work by doing like weightlifting and that kind of stuff and a lot of running, a lot of exercise and getting ready for the job. And I was really surprised to find that it required the minimal of physical activity. You know, it wasn't really that physical. And then I went into work, and I was very, very up. I remember, really, I was so happy to have gotten this job, you know. It meant I was going to be making about $3,000 a year more than I had been making before that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a kid to take care of, so that was very important to me. And so I was really very, very happy. And I walked in, and I remember seeing the men, and I walked right up to them. I was such a silly girl. it was so funny when I think about it now. I went up to them and I said hello, and I, told them my name and asked them, what's your name? And I went up to one guy in particular and I did that, and he just stared back at me and didn't even put out his hand. And I just stood there, and all of a sudden it was like all the reality just came and smacked me right in the face. This is what it's really going to be about, And that was my first day at work.
So what was, now how did it work? Did you work with a journeyman, or
actually,
did the boss teach you was in charge of your on-the-job instruction?
Well, I had one immediate supervisor, and then he had a supervisor, and on my job, usually your boss and your supervisor, they're very much in contact, especially if you work in a plant, in what they call a heating plant. They're very much there with the workers, in terms of, like, their office looks down into the plant, so they can see everything you're doing, and, they'll call you, It's not like you have a boss sitting over there in some office upstairs, Usually he can just look right into the plant, or he'll come into the plant and he'll be, he has to look at some of the equipment, or he's, there's always, you could always be assured that at some point during the day, if you work during the day, you'll see his face. Unless he's like, there've been a few of them that I've heard that, the guys never see them. He sits up in the office and that's it. But what happened with my apprenticeship, most of the time I was working with the other woman apprentice. I did not work with the mechanic, hardly at all.
So, but isn't that the system that's ideally, that you work with the mechanic so that you learn, mechanic is supposed to be teaching you what he knows?
Of course.
Isn't that the whole idea of the apprenticeship?
That's supposed to be it.
Theoretically.
Yeah, right. That's the way it's supposed to be. But we ended up working with each other, I would say, 3/4 of the time for the entire 3 years that I was there. She wasn't there at first. At first, I was the only woman. And then about 6 months later, she came. The other woman came in.
And did any men intervene in this process and tell you, share their skills with you or their knowledge, or sort of advise you about what was happening with your situation with the mechanic?
Not really. I think that there were, I think for my 3 year apprenticeship, while I was an apprentice, I think towards the end of my apprenticeship, I met up with one mechanic who was the most willing to share his experiences, because he was also being dumped on. He had had a problem with the union, from what I understand, and they were blackballing him, giving him a hard time. And so they put him to work where I was working, and I had a terrible, terrible boss, and he gave him a hard way. And this guy happened to be in the trade for a very long time. He was an engineer, not just a mechanic. And he was good at what he did, And he was the most willing to help myself and the other woman to learn something about what we were doing. But that was like at the very tail end of our apprenticeship. Most of that time, I did not work with a mechanic. Or if I did, it was sporadically, One day I would work with one guy, another day I would work with another guy, or I would work with one in the morning and then work by myself, cleaning, mopping, sweeping, dusting, painting.
It gave you a lot of that kind of work.
A lot of that kind of work. So that, and then when we complained to the union about it, they said to us, well, you know how the guys are, this is really a man's job for such a long time, they're having a hard time accepting you, don't worry about it.
And the union never came in and tried to act as a force for teaching people about the law or trying to ease the road.
No. And on top of which, our apprenticeship at the union school was 8/9 of it was theory, and 1/8 of it was practice, practical experience. There was no shop. There was no, virtually no shop. I think we had shop like a couple of days in one class, and that was it. So it's very difficult, I think, not just for myself and not just for the women, also I think probably for the men, to transfer what you learn theoretically to what your reality is, because a lot of times what you learn in theory is not in actuality what you do in practice.
Yeah, it seems like a hands-on kind of thing would be a lot more useful.
Definitely, at least I believe that it should have been half of our apprenticeship, at least half.
What kinds of problems or what kinds of experiences did you have with the classes? Did you find the classroom work, the theoretical work, accessible, and was
what
it difficult?
Mean? Oh, what was it like, hard to understand and learn? Well, this is going to be difficult for me because I want to be able to be honest and what's, you know, this thing about putting into the archives is where it makes it difficult for me, because I'm making a very big indictment of my union, because I feel, number one, they made out the books. They made the books, and they took, I don't know where they got the information, but I'm sure that they knew, and they, you know, these people that put together these books got information from other books, from having read from their own experience, and put these books together, and they were an added expense to all of the expenses that we had, right? We had to buy these books.
Mm-hmm.
And these books had no indexes in them. There was no index, there was no, you know, at the end of the book where it tells you, when you
right.
look through the index
yeah.
to see when you want to look for a particular subject, they were non-existent. There must have been about 5 or 6 books, really thick, really, really big, thick volumes, you know, and no indexes. So how in the hell are you supposed to find something if it's, you know? And as a matter of fact, one of our teachers, in fact, said that those books were virtually useless. He said, if you don't have an index in a book, when you want to look up the information, then you have to go through the entire volume of books to see what the hell you're looking for. And that's not very encouraging. So that was one of the things. But I think also the other thing is that it was not very easy, because it's not very easy to transfer what you learn in theory to what you learn in practice. And also that a lot of the learning I felt was, now I did learn a lot from it. You know, it helped me to understand certain basics about what I was doing, you know. So it's not like I didn't learn anything from the theory, you know. I think that the little bit that I do know, I learned because of school, more so than from the practical experience, you know. But a lot of the times what I felt was that the schooling was geared more towards preparing you for test taking, so memorization, test taking, getting your licenses, that kind of stuff, as opposed to the actual learning. You know, part of it, I think, it has to do with, for me anyway, as a woman, and I would imagine probably for some of the other women, historically being a student with all these men and a male teacher, and we had one teacher that would always tell us to ask questions. This was actually my very first teacher when I went to this to the apprenticeship school. He was a very learned man. He really knew his stuff. You can tell that he knew his stuff. And he was a very pleasant man, you know, on a personal level, you know. I don't really know him, because I wasn't, you know, wasn't really friends with him, but the little bit of time that we did, you know, interact, he was very pleasant with me, and I found with most of the other students. But he would tell us that we could ask any questions, and then I would see any time that anyone would ask him a question that he felt was challenging him, he would go berserk yelling at these guys. I mean, it was incredible.
And that was your first experience?
That was my first experience. These guys would say, well, what about this, and how about that, and how come I don't understand this? And he would go off, and virtually the class went quiet. Virtually went quiet.
You mentioned that you had a child,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to work, being there at 7 a.m., you're going to school till 9 p.m., sometimes up to 4 nights a week. How did you manage this big burden of schoolwork and childcare? And also, what did your weekends look like? Were you just studying all weekend? How did you get through this?
What happened was when I got into this trade, my son was 13, going on 13, not quite 13, he was 12 going on 13. So he needed some supervision, but he was also able to be alone, you know? But it was very difficult. I felt a lot of guilt because I would be gone before he was ready to go to school, and a lot of times I wouldn't get home until he was in bed, you know? So that was really very hard for me, you know? But I needed to make a living. I needed to be able to pay the bills. And so I just kept going. I mean, I think it was just sheer will. And I think also that my, partly it was that my son, you know, was, you know, almost 13 years old. So a lot of the times there were a lot of things that he could do by himself. But I think emotionally, it was very difficult for both of us, for both him and myself. Mm-hmm.
What about support? Where did you get support for going through all this?
Mostly from other women. In particular, it wasn't a family thing. I didn't get a lot of support from my family. It was mostly other women. I remember one time I spoke with a woman from United Trades Women. I got in contact with them. And for me, that was...
this point, they were very active.
Right? At that point, they were very active. And it was something that was very important to me. I really needed to be in contact with other women, knowing that I wasn't the only one going through this experience. And so the first time I ever met this woman was over the phone, and I just started crying, just wailing away. Because I just really... And also at that time, I didn't have a phone, because... when I had separated from my lover at that time, I couldn't afford to have a phone, so I disconnected it until I was able to get it later, but at that point I didn't have it,
so
I was out in the street.
Cut off.
Yeah, I was out in the street talking to her, just wailing away. But it was very important for me to have that kind of connection with other women in the trade.
And what about attending any of their meetings or events? It must have been hard for you to do that. Did you do any of that?
Yes, I did. I did a lot of that, you know. And as a matter of fact, I had to make a choice, you know. And for me, it was that. It's funny because I had to make a choice between being involved in something to sustain me spiritually and staying at home and hitting those books all the time. And I chose going out and sustaining myself. And so I got through my apprenticeship. I did pretty okay, you know, in my apprenticeship. But, there was one fella, I think this was one of the big saving graces for me in the school, who to this day is still my friend. He was in my apprenticeship, and he was an older West Indian man who was not afraid in terms of his skills. He was not afraid of the women and the women doing their jobs and learning, and he understood a lot about oppression and that kind of stuff. So if I didn't know something and if I was unsure about something, he didn't act like I should know it, you know, or what's wrong with you for not understanding that, you know. He would just, you know, help me or tell me or show me. You know, but it's very difficult because he lived all the way out in Queens and I lived in the Bronx, so I wasn't going to be traveling up to Queens after going there 5 days a week and then, you know, all the schooling. Mm-hmm. And so we kept in contact a lot by phone, you know, and sometimes we'd visit, and he's, to this day, we're still friends. So that was a really good thing for me, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Important.
Yeah, it was very important. Mm-hmm.
Yvonne, I want to switch over to another subject, but before I do, I want you to describe the physical plant that you were working in, because most of us have never been inside one of these facilities, nevertheless, you know, never mind work there.
Mm-hmm.
So give me a...
Okay, we had two very big boilers, 40 million BTUs is what they call them. They're very, very big boilers. These things are like maybe... one and a half stories high, you know, and about, I'm very bad in terms of like space with and what have you. But they're very big, you know, 40 million BTUs, 350 degrees, you know, under pressure. So that if anything, I mean, it never happened, but if anything were to puncture any one of those pipes, the steam that would come out, you wouldn't see it until it was like way many, a whole bunch of feet in front of you. So that if something like that happened, number one, if the plant was closed down, it would suck all the air out of the space. And number two, you wouldn't see the condensation, so you have to be very careful, because steam at that pressure could slice your head off, you know, and you wouldn't even see it because it moves so fast. People think that when you see steam that you can see it, but you actually don't see it until it starts cooling off and condensing. And by the time it starts cooling off and condensing, you could still get severely burned, because 350 degrees is a lot of degrees.
It's hot.
Very hot. Then they have
why are they generating the steam? Where is it going on your job?
Oh, on that particular job, it was going all over into different areas of the airport. When I was working at the airport, and it would generate the heat to keep the space warm, and it would also generate heat that would be like a secondary part of this heat would be to heat water and to keep the water hot. You know, that would be the secondary job of the steam. That's what it was for. Mm-hmm. And then they also had air conditioners, but they're not air conditioners like you see in home apartments hanging out the windows. These are industrial air conditioners. They're very big machines, you have what they call the cooling tower, which is works with the air conditioners, and that was a whole other separate building next to the heating plant. You have pumps in the heating plants that move the water throughout the system. You have a smaller equipment that you might be repairing for like some particular individuals that worked at the facility. They may have their own personal air conditioner for that particular space, you know, and then you'd have to work on those kind. But a pretty big space. It's not the biggest you can find, but it was pretty big and a lot of equipment.
So how did you psychologically adapt yourself to this new kind of environment that was very strange, I would assume, and foreign to you?
Well, I'll tell you, adapting myself to the environment was not such a difficult thing to me, in terms of that I had always, from when I was very young, been very much interested in what was happening in the backgrounds of things. So I would, I lived near the docks in Manhattan. And
back when they were real docks,
yeah, right,
real ships,
yeah, right,
real workers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And trains going through there, and trucks and all kinds of stuff. It was really at that time, and that was always very exciting to me. I would go, you know, I was a sort of a tomboy, whatever that means, but I would go out with the boys, and we would go to the docks, and we would investigate the trains and the trucks and the what have you that they had back there. So that was always something very interesting to me, you know, very intriguing, was finding out what was in the background of whatever looked really beautiful, you know what I mean? And so I found it very exciting to be there, you know, to finally get a chance to see it. And to, I think the part for me that was the most disappointing was getting there to see it and then being held back from being able to really learn it and really get my hands on it. That was the hardest part for me. But the physical space itself, I think, became oppressive when I felt the holding back of information. Then I didn't want to be there, because there were, you know, usually in these places, well, in this particular plant, there weren't a lot of windows, and they would close it, and you'd be indoors, and sometimes you could be indoors, like, all day, you know, and there's no real sunlight. You have to walk outside. And then you have a space where you're dealing, you know, you're working with people who are not very, who were, for me, not the most friendliest people, and I don't think that it was personal that they were not being friendly. I think it was, you know, the whole I think historically, you have to look at the history of apprentices and also you have to look at the conditions of production workers and people who do this construction and maintenance, because I'm in the maintenance trades, and their history, you know, and the alienation that we have from our jobs. And then when you have a boss like the one that I have, nobody wants to be there. I wasn't the only one. I'm sure the guys didn't want to be there.
How many workers are we talking about?
There were
about.
Oh, and well, there was a rotating shift, but there was a day crew. And in the day crew, there could have been anything. Well, I think it was like 20, 25 guys, you know. And then they had, on the rotating shift, there would be like two men. And that would be it, just two.
But in a very large space.
In a very large space, yes. Mm-hmm.
What, switching over to the subject of the union,
mm-hmm.
what was your first experience with the union when you decided to do something that we could call organizing in an informal sense? What's the first kind of action that you did or activity you got involved in?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, there were a couple of things. One of the first things was very informal. The women would get together. And there were a few women. We weren't all in the same year apprenticeship, you know. But we would get together and we would go to the coffee shop and we would talk and we'd talk about what was happening on the jobs and what our separate personal experiences were. So that was the first informal thing that we did. The next thing that happened for me was having to bring a suit against my boss, who had been like, to really abusing me and the other woman that I worked with. He was extremely abusive, and at this point what he had done was he had tried to keep us from being able to take a test to go on to the next level and become full-fledged mechanics as opposed to just apprenticeships, which gave him a tremendous amount of power over us, because he could let us go at any, you know, at any moment. He could just say, well, you know, they're not working out, or he could do whatever he wanted to. We'd lose our job, you know? So it was, he had a tremendous amount of power over us at that point, you know? And who knows, if he had not done this, I was really glad that he did it, because if he had not actually gone out of his way to try to keep us, and the way that he did it, because it was three apprentices, two of us were women, and one a male, and he had the least amount of time. We both had 3 years, and according to our contract, after having been an apprentice for 3 years, we were entitled to take the test. We had to have finish our apprenticeship, which we had. We had to have our refrigeration license, which both of us had, and we had to have 3 years of experience, which the two of us had. And the fella had half of that and didn't have any of his licenses. Well, we all applied. He was accepted to take the test, and the day before the test, I found out that the test is going to happen, and he's going for the test, and we haven't even been notified. We haven't even been notified that we can't take it, you know? So we immediately contacted the union, and the union stopped the whole thing. And thank goodness that he did this. You know, there was a letter in our file that said that we should not be allowed to take the test because we were not prepared, you know? All of a sudden, a letter appeared in the fella's file also. But in the meantime, he had been accepted, you know? But if he had not done that...
Well, the union backed you up on that.
Yes, they had to. It was really so blatant, the sexism that was happening. It was just so blatant.
And so you didn't have to do an actual lawsuit, but you had to just get the union to do...
Yeah, get on their, you know, P's and Q's and do what they're supposed to be doing, you know? And it was only at that point that they... that any issue became of the fact that we had not been trained properly. So in my files, there is actually a letter that says, number one, that we had not been trained properly. Number two, that we were going to be allowed to take the test. And number three, that there had been overtime that was given out to the male apprentice that was not given out to us. And so we were entitled to 60 free hours of overtime we could get either in compensation or in money.
And did they start doing anything about the training problem?
No, absolutely not. And by that point, we had finished with our apprenticeship, you know? So that was out of the question. We didn't, there was, you know, it wasn't about them you know, getting them to train us or anything like that. At that point, we had finished our apprenticeship. We then, and what was so funny was that a whole bunch of people took the test, and a whole bunch of people who had been apprentices in different facilities went and took the test. And I knew this one particular fella who had just finished getting off a ship where he was doing this exact same work, came into to New York City, went into the apprenticeship, took the test, and came out last on the list, and I came out, okay. Oh, great. Anyway, this fella.
You were saying you came out where on the test?
Okay, well, what happened was this fella had a tremendous amount of experience in this field. He came out at the bottom of the list, and I came out at the top of the list with the least amount of experience. So that made me feel like, you know, I was glad that I made it, you know, and I felt like I had earned it just because I had to go through all of this shit. But I was really pissed, and I was really angry, and I felt like this was a real insult. Because if they had allowed us to take the test, like we were supposed to be allowed to take the test, maybe I wouldn't have passed it, and maybe then I would have had to have fought for, listen, I'm not passing this test because I'm not getting the training, and who knows, whatever, or maybe it wouldn't have happened, because there was another woman I met who was in this trade who for 5 years was taking the test and not passing it for all kinds of reasons that I won't go into right now. But I mean, it really felt like an insult that this fella, who I knew had the experience, would come out at the bottom of the list, and me, who didn't have the experience, would come out at the top. That made me really know that this was all about tokenism, this was all about covering their own ass. It had nothing to do with me being sure that I would be a good mechanic, you know? And they didn't give a shit, you know? And when I went to my next job, they tried to tell me that I would lose my job because I didn't know how to do my work, and I told them I'm not going anywhere. I've worked hard, I've earned my place here, and I have a family to take care of. I'm not leaving this job, so forget about it, you know? And if we have to go downtown and go through this all over again, I don't mind. I'm willing to go through it. Because Jane, I'll tell you, you wanna know? The reason why we won this whole suit with the union and with my supervisor in terms of being able to take the test, getting back the overtime, and getting it written down that we had been inappropriately trained, was because I fought for that. Not so much the union, but the union was there, I felt, from my perspective, for show, you know? And I'm sure they came in and they thought that they did it. But let me tell you, I made a list of questions that I wanted to ask about what was going on. And when we had the meeting with the top people at my job around these issues, I said that I wanted to speak. And when I got my chance to speak, they were busy talking about ships in the horizon and philosophically speaking about my life and my job. And I didn't feel like being bothered with that shit, you know? So when I finally got a chance to speak, I pulled a list out of my pocket and asked very pointed questions. And they kept, like, one of the things was around this overtime, and they said, well, you know, he got, the fella, he got, like, I don't know how many hours of overtime. Like, in 3 years, I made, like, maybe 40 hours of overtime. In a year and a half, he had 150 hours of overtime. So when I asked them about why, they said that the reason was because he wasn't going to school, you know, because he had gotten hurt and he wasn't going to school. And I said, well, I only go to school on Tuesdays and Thursdays, so I'd like to know if for a year and a half, the overtime fell on every Tuesday and Thursday. Oh, well, we don't know that. And I said, well, let's get the paperwork. Let's get it down here, let's look at it, and let's find out why this man was able to make 150 hours of overtime in a year and a half, and in 3 years, I only have 40 hours of overtime. Did it conveniently come every Tuesday and Thursday? Because I was out of school Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I don't understand this, you know? And the same thing happened in a few other occasions when we were talking with these people. So So that I felt that the reason why we were able to win a lot of that stuff was because I asked those very specific questions. When they talked about us not being able to take the test, I said, I want to see the contract that we signed that said that we were supposed to be able to take the test after 3 years. Why is it one way for us and a different way for the fella? I want to know why. Well, you know, we don't, blah, blah, blah. I want to see it in writing, you know? And they were forced, even though they never answered my question, they were forced to have to recognize that if they did not take me seriously, that this could go a lot further than what it was going. And plus, they also, my immediate supervisor was trying to cover for someone because he had done something seriously wrong, you know? And so that's why we got what we got. I mean, it was a horrible experience. It was a good experience, but it was a horrible. It was made me really angry to have to go through that. I was really pissed to have to do that.
So after that, did that translate into union activity for you?
Well, what happened was I went, like I said, to the second facility to work and to become a full-fledged mechanic. And there I was working with a much larger group. It was a different kind of setup. I wasn't working in a heating plant. I was working more at a transportation facility, you know. The equipment was all over the building, you know. And I was working in more midtown Manhattan. I wasn't working at the airport. And I knew that it would feel a lot better for me working there because I knew I would feel a lot better being able to leave the building and walk into the general community, whereas at the airport I felt very isolated and alienated there.
What kind of transportation?
The Port Authority terminal, bus terminal. And so that they, you know, a lot of people didn't like that place because of the homeless and the what have you, but it gave me more sense of being where the people were at, you know, as opposed to being in this really sterile kind of environment, which I found the airport to be. The airport is a lot more airy, a lot more light, you know, that you get because it's low, close to the ground, not too many tall buildings around it, you know. But here it was, you know, being out with the people. So when I left work, I didn't feel as oppressed about it, you know.
And the dynamics of your work group, was that different that allowed you to?
Oh, definitely. I was working at the airport. I was working around primarily white men, and at this facility, I was working around primarily black men. You know, and that by no means does that translate into not having to deal with shit. You know, by no means. Please do not make that mistake. You know, but what it did do, it changed the whole dynamic for me. Number one, I wasn't dealing so intensely with the racism as, you know, in the same kind of way. These men understood oppression themselves. And these white men, by no means, do not think that they don't understand oppression. They are oppressed as workers, you know. But they have this other privilege that they can lean on, whereas these black and Latino, mostly black men, didn't have that privilege. So that was something that was like a relief for me. I didn't have to deal with that so blatantly and so much, you know. Then the other thing was that it was a much larger crew. I worked with people from different trades all together. We were working all together. I wasn't working in a heating plant. I was working at a facility that had different tenants. They had different kinds of machinery in it. And then they would have rooms that was only the machinery we were working on. We didn't have boilers here either. And I didn't work with the watch engineers hardly at all, because they worked primarily in the refrigeration room, because we did have air conditioning, and they worked primarily in there. So they worked separate from the rest of the crew most of the time. You didn't see them, and they worked on a rotating shift where we worked steady days only. And what happened here was, like I said, I went to work here and they tried to challenge me for not knowing my job, and I challenged them right back. And then while I was working there, I realized that we had no shop steward, you know. And I approached my union about it and asked them, and we have in our union, we have what they call it, appoint their shop stewards, so they don't get voted in. The shop stewards are appointed by the union. And so they wanted to appoint me, but I told them, no, let's have an election, and I will take responsibility for making that happen, you know.
Have you been going to union meetings?
No, I had not been going to union meetings because I was going to school at the union hall, and so when the union meetings would come up, I would be in the classroom rather than in a meeting.
So when you got on the Port Authority job, did you start going to union meetings?
I was at the Port Authority job all along. The entire time I was at the Port Authority. But what happened was that I was in a lot of contact with the union and the union representatives and agents and what have you, because I was there every Tuesday and Thursday, sometimes Wednesdays and Fridays as well, all the time, every week. So there was a lot of contact with these people, so I was very familiar with the space and with the people and with the whole head. You know, where they were at, you know, mentally. So
did they agree to this election?
Well, they agreed. He agreed because I did not want to get appointed. I felt like that would not be good for me. It would make my position weak, you know, because I had already, like from the onset, had problems with the men right from the beginning when I first went to this facility. Because as a matter of fact, when I was an apprentice, the fellas had told me that once I became a mechanic, I wasn't going to have to put up with any more of this garbage, and then I could then perpetrate this garbage onto the next apprentice, which is exactly what their mentality is. And this is also not just a system. I think that historically, I mean, when we look at the history of apprentices have always been shitted on by the mechanic. The next person that became the mechanic then was able to shit on the apprentice. You carry my tools, you wipe up my shit, you pick up my garbage, you know, you clean up the space, I get to make the fine work, and you look, and whatever little bit I give you, you'll be happy with that and wait till you become a mechanic and then you learn, right? But here I was at this facility, and we had, like I said, no shop steward, and so they said okay, and we had this, and what I did was I put out notices all over saying that there was going to be, you know, we're going to hold nominations to put down their, you know, elections, and that they should nominate whoever they wanted to, and I put down what the stipulations were in order to be able to be nominated, that you had to be a full-fledged union member, which everybody was not, you know, and dues-paying full-fledged union member, you know, and a few other stipulations, I forget what they were and what they are now. And so I did this, and I said, you know, the elections will be held however many, I think it was a month and a half later. Well, lo and behold, it came the day for the elections, and nobody nominated anybody. Nobody. Myself and another woman. That was it. You know? So I called up the union on that day, and I told them, appoint us. They're not wanting to participate, you know? And they appointed us, and they sent a letter to our bosses, you know? And we became the shop steward.
Now, how do you explain this? First of all, on the one hand, you're thinking that you wanted to do this job and that you could do the job with all these guys. And second of all, that you didn't get discouraged when there's such a lack of participation that you just said, to heck with it, you know. And,
what do you mean?
Well, in terms how can of you be an effective shop steward when there's so much apathy? I mean, that didn't seem daunting to you, that, you know, you had to say, this is going to be rough. It was a challenge.
Well, what it was that I...
What was driving you?
I think at that point, I was beginning to see that, first of all, that we didn't have a shop steward, and I felt like that would be a good experience for me. I really wanted to be able to get that kind of experience. I think that was the primary force for me behind the whole thing. And also that I could see that the injustices that were happening, in particular to myself, the stuff that was happening to me, and I felt like, somebody's got to be standing here for me, you know? If I got to do it for myself, you know? Somebody's got to be saying, no, this is not going to be the way that it is. You can't just do whatever you feel like it whenever you want to. And so I said, well, let me be the person. What the heck?
Had you had union experience before that you recognized the whole role of a steward? And
no, that was
the
first.
Did you learn at the apprentice school? Did they talk about the ideal way that the union would function in the workplace and the role of the stewards? Did they educate you?
They gave us a course on it. I think it lasted like 1 or 2 days, and it was a couple of hours. So it wasn't like it's to me what it felt like a real farce, because what happens and what I see about this is that they're not really wanting to encourage people to take over. You know, it's like they want to be the imperial force forever and ever and ever.
Knowledge is power.
Right.
We'll
and so keep it and keep it away from them. And if they don't know, then they don't become powerful and they don't begin to challenge what we're saying. Is like I would go to meetings, some of the union meetings sometimes, and they'd sit there and, you know, the guy would mumble whatever he was saying. You couldn't understand what he was saying. And then they would say, "We're going for a vote, all yays," and everybody would yay, and they didn't know what the hell they were yaying about. And there was never, ever, ever, I never, ever remember anyone saying nay. Never. And then you'd ask somebody, what was that about? They didn't know. They had no idea what they were yaying. As a matter of fact, one time, they yayed somebody out of the union, and they didn't even know why. They didn't even know who it was. God, they threw them right out of the union, and no one had any idea as to who the person was, what the problem was, and why the union was trying to get rid of them. That is a shame. That is a serious offense, you know, to another worker. I think that's a horrible thing, you know.
So you see all this, but you go ahead and you get yourself in the position where you're going to be on the front lines and representing the union and fighting for your coworkers.
But, on the other hand, being a shop steward, and this is what I learned by being a shop steward, it put me in a much more powerful position, you know, and something that I was not expecting. That was something I wasn't expecting, but it was so nice. I'll tell you, it was so nice, because the kind of power that I got was more in terms of being able to have more control over myself, in terms of and being taken seriously. There was no way that they could like not just disregard me like I was, you know, a fly on the wall, you know, when something, and then when I was very good, I was very good.
How did you learn to be good?
I think the thing that made me good was that I believed in what I was doing, and I believed in unions, and I believed that we had rights, you know, and I think for me, the biggest force in terms of in terms of taking this stand and in terms of understanding it, was actually my experience with the women. With the women in United Trades Women, with the other women, and the things that we were talking about, and also beginning to understand something about unions and what they were supposed to be about and what they were supposed to be doing. That was, I actually did not learn most of that from my union. I learned it from being around the women and being around United Trades Women and listening to other women's stories, you know, and what was the responsibility of the union. That's how I learned it. And I really believe it, and I still believe it, even though I think that they're a horrible organization. I still very strongly believe in the union and in union principles, you know. But it was a very empowering experience to be a shop steward.
Did the other woman become a steward also?
She became a steward, but then shortly thereafter she left. And she was also working a rotating shift, so she was not able to exercise it the same way that I was. Mm-hmm. And eventually she left and went to another facility, and she was not the shop steward there, you know. And she went to the facility that I had been at, that I had just left. Mm-hmm. And the shop steward there, who was a man, was the most horrendous, horrific person you ever met. This guy had 500 hours of overtime while the other workers had 150. I mean, this guy was in the boss's office every day. But he also had very heavy connections in the union. And no one argued with him, no one refuted him, no one questioned. I mean, the guys didn't like it. They saw that it was unfair. But they wouldn't say a word.
So I'm interested in hearing about some of the struggles that you had and some of the things that you did to build solidarity and also learning about how your relations changed with the people that you were representing.
Okay, now, it's very interesting because what I did first when I became a shop steward was, this is so funny, because we get this letter that says that now I'm officially the shop steward, and all of a sudden now one of the engineers comes up to me and tells me, oh, well, I wanted to be a shop steward. I would have been the shop steward. I didn't mind doing that. And I looked at him square in his face and I tell him, well, it's too late. I'm the shop steward now. And when you had an opportunity to do it, you didn't do it. So tough, you know? And then once I became a shop steward, then it seemed like a lot of the fellas started beginning. They themselves like took the initiative. They said, oh, we have somebody to protect our rights, you know? And so they would come to me if they had a problem, you know? And what I found, it was very, very interesting, you know, with a few things that I found, but one of the things in terms of working with the fellas, what I found was a lot of times the men that I was working with, they would, number one, they would complain about something and then not want to take a stand on it, you know. And so I would end up standing up there by myself, you know, and sometimes looking kind of foolish. Number two, that they didn't want to put things down in writing, you know, and so I would, you know, begin the writing process, you know. And then number three, that they would not tell me the whole story. They would hold things back, you know. And so if by not telling me, and I finally had to tell them, I said, if you don't tell me the whole story, the good, the bad, the in-between, where you think you're wrong, where you think that you're right, where they're wrong, where they're right, if you don't tell me everything, then when I go up to them, I look like an asshole because I don't know what the hell I'm defending you about, you know? I'm saying one thing and they're telling me, no, this happened. And then you're standing right there and you're saying, well, yeah, you know, well, why didn't you tell me? Excuse me, you know, but I don't read your brain, you know? And so I had to tell them and they still would not do it. They still would not do it. They had a resistance. And I think partly it was a resistance to authority, you know, and their own fears. And partly I think it was also they're not wanting to take responsibility for being a worker, you know. Their political unclarity about what it meant to be a worker and who was the worker and who was the boss and why he was the boss and what makes you the worker, you know what I mean? And so a lot of times, you know, I'd be arguing at a point with the boss and I'd have half of the story, you know, of what was going on. And in the end, it was funny because quite a few of them, they would get angry at me because what happened was I would argue a case for them and then I would come up with because I was a shop steward, it was so interesting, because I was a shop steward partly, and partly I think it was because of my personality and the way that I presented myself, because I didn't play games around stuff like this. I was straight up. I didn't take any favors from the bosses. I didn't take any favoritism from the boss. I took my place as a worker, and that was fine with me. I didn't want them to give me anything extra, unless I was entitled to it, because that was in the contract for me to get as a shop steward. Otherwise, I didn't want it, you know. Now, one of the things I could have gotten was more overtime than most of the other guys. But I said, no, this is the way we're supposed to go. We'll go according to that list. I'm not going to take money out of these people's pockets, you know. So what happened was, is that because of that, a lot of times the supervisors and the bosses, they would, and I think also partly because they kind of liked the fellas, some of them, you know. And this one particular fellow that I worked with who was, he had a horrible case. They liked him, you know. And so they were kind of lenient, you know, on him, you know. And on some of the other fellas, they were kind of lenient on him. But then what happened was that they wanted more than that, you know, but they were not willing to cooperate with me. And so they would all, that's what they would get. They would get whatever they were going to get, that was it. That's what they would get. And so they started blaming me. They started blaming me for their not getting it or they started blaming me because, like, this one fella had a record that was like Swiss cheese, you know. He would hardly ever come to work, you know. He wouldn't call. He would come in when he came in. He would come in late, you know. I mean, this was a record that they had been accumulating on him over a period of 3 years. The guy had 15 years working for this company. But in the last 3 years, he was doing really very, very bad, really very bad. And I'm looking at the records, and there's no way that I can argue with that. I can't argue with the records. The facts say you're not coming in, you're not making a full week any week, you know. You're taking over and above your time allotted for sick days. You're not, you know, they asked him, listen, if you're having a problem, go down to the medical, get yourself medical coverage and, you know, paperwork and what have you. And tell them that you need that you need to go into a mental stress program, because they had a mental stress program in place, and stay out for a few weeks rather than doing this. You know, no, he didn't want to go. He didn't want to. He continued to, right after they would tell him, okay, well, you have 1 day in the street, we're going to keep you out of work for 1 day, no pay. The next day he would come in later, he wouldn't come in either. You know, I mean, it was really horrible. This guy was really terrible. And I particularly like this person, and so I would tell him, I would sit down, I would talk to him, what's the problem, what's going on. Now, in retrospect, I think the problem was probably drugs. I think, I'm not sure, but that's my feeling about it, you know, looking back, because he was totally irrational when we would talk, you know. So one day I finally had a time to listen. If you were working anyplace else other than here, you'd be in the street. You'd have lost your job a long time ago, you know. We got into a big argument. The fellas knew what this guy's record was about, and still they insisted that it was my fault. They also insisted that I, even though I was I'd be standing there, you know, arguing the point for them, and even if they were wrong, they wanted me to get whatever it was that they wanted when I couldn't get it, you know, and they would blame me, you know. So.
Did grievances go to the next stage, and did you have somebody come from the union who could take the heat off in a way?
Well, what I did have that at one point, but actually this was a very difficult thing, and this again is a very strong indictment against my union. What happened was I was a shop steward, and then we had one person that was in charge of all the shop stewards, you know, and he was a representative of the union. He actually worked for the company. He did not work for the union, you know. And so he came down. I got him to come down and speak with the fellas and try to straighten things out and try to straighten out even this particular case I was telling you with this particular fella. But the union would not come down. And their contention was, you don't come to union meetings, so we're not going to come to you, you know. Which became like a catch-22 vicious cycle, because the fellows would say, well, they don't come to us, so why should we go to them, you know? And now the union is way out in Richmond Hill, Queens. That may not seem far away for some people, but for a lot of people it was, you know? I know that it was for me.
Is that where they had the union meetings?
That's where they had the union meetings, that where they had everything there. It used to be in Manhattan, but they relocated out there, I think probably because they have a lot more union members that live in Long Island, you know. And because of the kind of governmental agency that I worked for, we were not covered by the NLRB, you know. So anyway, I was able to get this fellow to come down, I think once or twice, you know. But no one from the union would come, no one. And like I said, their whole thing was, well, they don't come to union meetings, so we're not going to come down there to them. Plus, also, a lot of the guys were not full-fledged union members. A lot of them were not full-fledged union members because they didn't trust the union, because the union had not come through for them. And it became a really horrible catch-22 situation, because I felt like it was incumbent upon the union to take that first step, you know, to begin to, that's why they are the organizers, you know. That's why they're the people that get paid the union dues, you know, because they're supposed to go out there, come out there on the sites and encourage the people to continue to want to be union members. We are now in the middle of negotiations, and they're getting ready to sell us right down the drain. They're getting ready to work out some kind of a deal with the Port Authority, where they're going to where the Port Authority is going to be able to contract the work out directly from the union hall, instead of instead of it being where people could come in and get the job, anyone can come in and get the job and then become a union member. In order to get the job with the Port Authority, you have to go through, you have to be in the union, and then the union will hire these people out to the Port Authority for X amount of time until the job was done, and then they would leave and they would go on. So,
is there any opposition within the ranks?
We have no rank and file. There's no rank and file movement whatsoever within that union. None whatsoever.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, based on your experience, how long were you a shop steward?
Okay, well, I was a shop steward for the entire time that I worked at that facility, which was, I became a shop steward, I think, I was at the facility for a little over 2 years, about 2 years, and I became a shop steward about 6 months after, so about a year and a half I was a shop steward, you know. And what was interesting was that as a shop steward, I gained a lot of respect, because even though the men were, they were jealous because of the kind of power that I had, you know, and that I, and the kind of courage that I had to take these people on. And they also, one time we had a meeting, and the manager of the facility that I worked at was a female, and she came to the meeting, and one of the fellas asked a question that had to do with safety and health. And she allowed for her crony to belittle this guy and to make him feel like, you know, well, if you want that question answered, you come to my room later on and I'll answer it to you later, not now, we don't want to take. And this was supposed to be a round table meeting where we were supposed to be talking about safety. It was a safety meeting, that's what it was, not a round table meeting. Man, let me tell you, he finished saying that and the meeting started going into another direction and my blood started boiling. And I said, wait a minute, I have something to say, you know. And I stood up and I told him, you cannot do that. This is a safety question. You have to answer his question and you have to do it right here in front of everybody. And those people that are here, because there were a lot, because it was an asbestos question, there were a lot of guys that were tired. And that was another thing I always stood up for the safety, you know, question, which these guys were afraid of taking a stand on, you know. I said, this is a question about asbestos. You have to answer that question, and you have to answer it here in front of everybody, where everybody gets the benefit of understanding what the answer is. His question is legitimate, you know, and anybody that is sitting here that doesn't want to listen, let them go. Let them get up and walk out of the room, because there was another shop steward. There were two other shop stewards that were in there. One was for the electrician and one for the general maintainers. And when he started asking questions, they both rolled their eyes and one of them got up and walked out the room like he was sick and tired of hearing this, I don't want to hear it, blah, blah, blah. How dare you? You're a shop steward. You're supposed to be in here. And you're supposed to stand up for anything that the workers say. Anything that they say that is legitimate, if they have to ask it a million times, they must have to ask it because they are not answering it adequately, you know? And so if you guys want to get up and walk out, get up and walk out and leave. But that question has to be answered right now. And the manager said to me, oh, Yvonne, he was just trying to tell him that he, you know, trusted his ability to be able to think things through. And I told him, that has nothing to do with anything. He is not an expert in that field. His field is whatever it was. That's where he's an expert. You want to ask him questions about that? You go ahead and ask him questions about that. But that is a safety question. He is entitled to an answer, and I don't want to hear it, you know? And don't tell me. If you guys don't have the answer, then say you don't have the answer and you don't know. And do your investigating and get back to us. But don't give me that. That's a crap. That is crap, you know? Well, my veins were coming out of my neck. You know, everybody was looking at me because at this point, I had to do everything that I could to keep from cussing these people out because these guys have given me a real wonderful vocabulary working around these men. It was just like my vocabulary was so colorful at this point, you know? So I had to do everything that I could to contain that. But by this point, I was standing up and I was talking, not yelling, but pretty forcefully. And let me tell you, that manager, she never again crossed me, never again. And this was a woman that would come into meetings with the men. She was a very attractive woman, and she would come into the meeting with all of these men, you know, and she would be busy sitting on the desk and crossing her legs back and forth, you know, and getting all kinds of sexy and what, get out of here. You know, this is not what this is about, you know. You want to play with that head in that way, do it over there in your office, but not over here. This is not what we come for, because now, me and this other woman, we have to deal with what you've done psychologically to this bunch of assholes here, because they're so hard up, they act like they've never seen it before, you know? Now we have to deal with it. You're the manager, you're supposed to be leading the pack. Who, you know, who's this? Our leader? For real? You know? But she never crossed me again after that. She never crossed me again, because I was very serious about what I was doing. And the fellas, they knew this about me. And it was the only reason why they would come to me all the time whenever there was a problem. They weren't willing to be honest. They weren't willing to take responsibility. But they would come to me because they knew that I would do everything within my power with whatever little bit they gave me, you know. And so I've gained the respect of my coworkers and of my supervisors. And which, as a matter of fact, one time when I was trying to defend this one guy who had that Swiss cheese racket, when I'm finishing trying to defend this guy, then my supervisor, who used to be a shop steward, said, well, if I was her and I was your shop steward, I would have learned a lot more than she did, you know, right there in front of me and him. Well, I told him, don't ever do that. When that guy left, I said, don't ever do that again, you know, because then you minimize what I'm here to do, you know. You can't do that. That's not right, you know, and he never did that to me again. But I think that's the reason why I was able to do what I did, because I was very serious, and as a matter of fact, my reputation went with me to the next place, which is where I'm working at right now.
What advice would you give to other women who are in a similar situation, working in a non-traditional job, working with a bunch of men?
Boys.
Dealing with a difficult union.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple of things that I did want to say, though, with that, is not just with the men, but I think the other thing, and I think this is very important also, when I mentioned earlier about the women and the women's group, because we did become a much more organized group after a while, and that became defunct. And
you're talking about UT now.
No, no, not UT. I'm talking about the women at the local 30, who tried to make a women's contingent. And this is partly my problem, so I want to take responsibility for a part of it, which I'm not really sure exactly how to work it out.
Was this an official group within this? Did you go to the union to set up an official group?
Yes, we did.
And what was their response?
Well, they were very paternalistic, and they said, of course the girls can have a meeting, and they can have a group, and they can use our room to have a meeting, you know.
How did you get in touch with the other women?
Well, I didn't organize this group. There was another woman that organized it, and myself and this woman, we did not get along. We did not see eye to eye. And one of the things that happened, we got together, and this is what I felt was really difficult, is that I felt that on the one hand, the women needed to find a place where they can go and talk about what was going on for them on their jobs, you know. And I have a tendency to work more from an organic place rather than something that is put upon us. And I have a tendency to feel that people work better and they can come to whatever stand they need to come to based on, you know, the organic part of it, you know, as opposed to being something that is put upon you. I think people people tend to be more afraid of that, you know, rather than something that comes from within themselves and they decide, this is what I want to do, this is how I want it to go. So we decided, you know, all together, we were going to get together and we had these meetings, right?
And how many women about?
There must have been, started out maybe about 20 women, you know? I mean, that's a lot. In terms of the union, it wasn't a lot. But in terms of our getting together, it was a lot, you know?
And did it represent most of the women who were in local 30?
I think so. A lot of the women were apprentices, and so we had it right there at the union hall. And before they went to school, they would come to the meeting. We'd have it once a week, you know? So before school, they would come to the meetings.
So you started this when you were an apprentice?
No, I was already a mechanic. Okay. It was more unofficial when I was an apprentice, but when I became a mechanic, we started to make it more of an official thing, you know? And we used the union facilities. Now, what happens is that because of the kind of work that we do, and we work in such a spread out type of situation, that a lot of the women that worked and lived near New Jersey or in New York City, you know, they wouldn't come to the meetings. And so they were asking that we would come to the city. So what I proposed was that we would have some meetings in the union hall to accommodate the women that were the apprentices there, and then use the facilities at, I forget, the labor union school over here on 42nd Street.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Empire State.
Empire State College. Yeah, that we used them because I knew that they would also be, you know, available to us. Well, there was opposition in that group. Let me just start this. Oh, great. Anyway, there was opposition to that. Then also the other thing that I raised was that we maybe begin, because we were trying to get some, and this is what I'm talking about, things working in from an organic place in an inorganic way. But we had decided, because everybody thinks that this is the way that groups works best, is to get all of these projects together. And this was just the proof that that's not the way that it works. And what happened was, okay, so we decided to get these projects together. I said, well, if we want to attack issues, I think one of the issues that we need to deal with and grapple with is childcare for the women. There are a lot of women that are not going to come into this trade or into the trades at all because there's no childcare provided for them and no sensitivity towards that area and that part of their life, you know. Well, the woman who was in charge of the group, she wasn't supposed to be in charge of the group, but she was, you know, and she took that stand.
Kind of put herself in.
Yeah, and the women allowed her. We, I think, allowed her to be in that position as well. So we have to take partial responsibility for that. But what happened was that she opposed that. She said, no, that's a man's issue, not just a woman's issue. And I said, it doesn't matter.
It is.
You know, that's not the point. The point is that we need it, and most times, 9 times out of 10, the women are the nurturers, and we're the ones who get grappled with the kids, you know, strapped with the kids. We're the ones who have to deal with it. You know, we want to come to work here, and we want to go to school, and there's nothing set up for us. Now, by this point, I didn't need it, because my son was already grown, you know, and I was already a full-fledged mechanic. It wasn't an issue for me, personally, you know. But I knew from past experience that this was something that was very important, and I also knew that there happened to be another woman apprentice who was not able to stay with the apprenticeship. She had to leave because of her children, you know. She had problems with that. And so so the women wouldn't take up that issue either. Then they wanted to have meetings with men in it to try to raise their consciousness, and I said, no, I'm not willing to do that. I don't want to do it personally, because I said, I am willing to support them in their struggle with themselves, but I'm not willing to sit here and babysit them and tell them, you're sexist. Later for that, you know? Okay, so anyway, what I was saying is that then, so they want, you know, one of the things that this other woman raised was having the men in our meeting, and I said, you know, I was opposed to that, so I was not ready, and some of the other women were, so that was crap. But then the other thing that I felt that was really very important that I raised as an issue, and I was really surprised and saddened that they didn't take it on, was our apprenticeship. The fact that we had been in an apprenticeship for 3 years and without any hands-on experience, without any shop, all theory, and how it was difficult enough for us as women to be in the trades, let alone trying to learn this trade at this late stage of the game, because we weren't playing, we weren't encouraged to play with these kinds of mechanical things when we were little girls, you know? So that it was very important for us, even more so than for the guys, that we have the shop classes. It's important for the guys as well, but even more so for us, because psychologically we were not prepared for this. You know, nowhere along our experience, very few women were prepared for this kind of stuff. And I was completely opposed on that issue. Because the union, one valve is the same as the next valve, it really doesn't matter. I mean, It was incredible. And I kept arguing the point, and no. And then finally, the next time that we got together, this very same woman had gotten some information on childcare. And when I came in, she just threw it at me. She threw at me this pamphlet. Here, you wanted it. And she threw it at me. This is for you. You wanted it. You're interested in it. And I opened it up and I looked at it and I says, no, you're wrong. It's not for me. It's for the other women. I don't need childcare. You know? But
what did they eventually start working on, or if anything,
it collapsed.
Were some of the projects that they thought they were going to work on?
One of the projects was, you know, I'm going to tell you something. Oh, this is what it was. One of the women got into a really big thing with the union. I mean, it was a really horrible situation that she got involved with the union. She was taking the union, getting ready to take them to court. I mean, it was really that bad. That's how bad it got. Where she had gotten some kind of harassment on the job when some fella had crawled through the ceiling into the lady's bathroom, looking over the lady's bathroom while she was in there. And she caught him, and they didn't want to press charges, and the union didn't want to. Then they threw the boss threw her out. They fired her. The union didn't want to do anything to help her out. I mean, it was a really horrible situation. But on the other hand, also, the woman, for I don't know what reasons, I'm not exactly sure, she also was not coming to school, you know. And so that's what they were standing on. Well, you don't come to school. She was also black. I think her mother at that time was very sick, you know. And she was having personal problems. Somehow, they were using one thing against the other, and they didn't want to back her up, you know. And in the end, she ended up, she got her her refrigeration license. She didn't stay with the apprenticeship. She got another job. The union was forced to find her another job. She got another job, and she just cut all ties with the union whatsoever. She still belongs to the union, because I think she pays dues, but she's completely and absolutely inactive. A lot of the women didn't bother to call her. I, as a matter of fact, tried to get her phone number from this one particular woman who was like the leader of the group, and she kept telling me that it was the same number that we had listed, but I would call the same number, and they kept giving me this message that it was no longer in existence. So I got in touch with her through somebody else, and finally I was able to talk to this woman and try to be there for her, you know. But it just collapsed after that. That was it, and nothing really came. We never got into any projects. I also told the woman who was the chairperson, who we had elected the chairperson, that we needed to get together and talk about what it meant to be a chairperson, what was the responsibility of the chairperson, how she, who had been so active in the union for all these years, because she had the most experience, you know, how she was able to, you know, approach the union, what she did, what was her experience. I felt that it was important for her to share that experience with the rest of us so that we could begin to find the courage to be able to deal with these white males, because that's what they were, the whole entire union, you know? Past that's
the one. You didn't respond to that.
No, never. And so it collapsed, and to this day, there's nothing happening, you know, in the union with the women. In terms of what I would suggest to other women, I think I would never say to women, don't participate in the trades. I think it's very important. I think it's a good idea. It's very good pay. In the end, it's really good pay. I would say to women that are deciding to go into the trades to prepare themselves. to prepare themselves in terms of their time, that they're going to have to give a lot of their time to it, you know. I would say to them to seek out one or two co-workers that they feel that they can respect in terms of their work, and try to align themselves with them in terms of getting some kind of help in terms of the experience, you know. That's not always easy, but that's one of the things that I would try in terms of on the job site type of things. I would say to them also that if at all possible to go to the union meetings, because the more exposure that you have at the union, the better it would be for you. Even if you're not planning on becoming active in the union, if they see your face all the time, and then the next time you go to ask for a job or you want to change to another job, it's not like, well, who are you? You know, I don't remember you. You know, where do you work at? You know, they see you there all the time. I tell them to not be idealistic, because just because they're doing that, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get whatever they think that they're entitled to. I'd say to them that to prepare themselves financially again for the apprenticeship, because a lot of times you have to buy books, car fare, there's lunch, there's the initiation fee to join the union. All these things, I think, with the exception, I think the union initiation fee and the building fund, some unions have that, mine did, you know, and they raid the shit out of you in terms of this money.
I need to ask what the building fund is.
Yeah. But you can pay in installments. You don't have to pay it all at once, you know. But I would tell them to not try to, quote, unquote, rip the union off, even though the union might be ripping you off. I would say don't try to play those kinds of games, because what happens is that if you don't pay your building fund and your union dues and your union initiation fee like everyone else has to do, they're going to remember that. They're going to remember that, and you're going to be the one that's going to be cut right out of the scene, you know?
What about advice in terms of the union and getting to be involved in the union, being an activist, playing a role?
I think that if at all possible, and there's a possibility for becoming a shop steward, I would say do that. But if not, if that's a difficult way to get in, then I would say to join one of the... they have a lot of different activities that are going on, you know, like they may have the, let's say, safety and health. They might have a group that's for, what do you call it, the credit union, you know. These are things that they may seem like minor little things, but it's the beginning way to get in, to get involved. And I would also say that if at all possible, try to get together with the women. Sometimes it's not possible for everybody to get together all at once because of the way that we're so spread out. You know, we don't really get to know each other, you know? I think that even if you can't get together, all of you together at one time, try to keep something going where the women are getting together, even if it's during the apprenticeship that the women apprentices go to the pizza shop and have pizza and soda together and talk about what's going on for them. Because you need a lot of that emotional support for all of the stuff that you're going to be going through while you're in the trades and while you're deciding to be in the trades. I think that it's a very important thing to do, you know, for women to be in the trades. I think it's very important. It's about time that we not only be able to participate in this way in the society, but I think that we, it's about time that we get paid this kind of money, because they get paid damn good money, you know? And a lot of them don't do diddly squat, you know? They get a lot of money and they sit on their hands, you know what I'm saying? And they don't know. They don't know any better than most of the rest of us know what the trade is all about. And I think it's a really sad commentary. I think not just for the men as workers, or for us as workers, that we don't know, you know, the trade that they would. And I think for me in particular, I'm not saying me only, but me in particular, excuse me, I don't like the feeling of not knowing my trade. It makes me feel very powerless, mm-hmm. You know? I think that that's another big issue that's going to have to be grappled with the unions in terms of the apprenticeship, you know, that they be responsible, that they be held accountable for that, you know?
You've talked about a lot of the problems, both on the job and the apprenticeship and the union, and you've said that UT was very important to you. Would you like to see United Tradeswomen get itself reorganized, reconstituted?
I think that there's another group now also. I think there's the New York Tradeswomen group, you know?
Well, whatever group it is, in terms of meeting with women, trying to provide support and trying to provide information and trying to act as a watchdog. What do you have to say about New York City and the kind of activities that are...
I'm glad that the New York Tradeswomen, I think it's called, is in existence now. I've not been a lot involved in it lately. I think partly because of what I told you earlier, which is that I'm planning on moving away, and I've been, I think, in the process of thinking of leaving the trade in the last year, you know, really considering it, very disappointed in a lot of ways struggle, I guess. I'm not sure what the word is, but I can't get it right now. In terms of being actively doing something, it's very discouraging. I think this time in history, it's not just women and not just the trades, but this time in history is a very discouraging time. There's not a lot of real activism going on. A lot of apathy.
Tremendous. Feels stalemated.
Yes. And I think that, I don't know what the answer is to that, but I think that that's certainly something that we need to begin to look at, you know, because it makes it very difficult for a woman, period, but in the trades, to be able to get the get up and go, to keep getting up and going. You know what I mean? I think a lot of women that have been in the trades for a very long time are beginning to feel it now, you know. It's like the getting to the point where you're just worn out, you know. I hate to say, because it's funny, because I don't feel like it's not that I feel like it should stop existing, or it should not be happening, you know, or that I don't see it as it's not that I see it as that that we have to just lie down and die, you know. But I don't have the answer. I don't know, you know, what direction to move in at this point in time in history. So that's all I know about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, any other words of advice or?
I would say one more thing. I'd say that when you get involved in this, when a woman gets involved in this, I think it's very important for her to have whatever space and time she needs to have in order to maintain her own center. You know, if it's that she likes to jog, if it's that she likes to do yoga, if it's that she likes to cook, if it's that she likes to read her book, you know, in quietness by herself. I think that all of us need that space and that place where we find that kind of at peaceness with ourselves, you know. You have to have that. I think if you don't, I think it gets really hectic and crazy in terms of all of the stuff that's going on. In terms of, especially for women apprentices, I think that's really very hard. And I think also the other thing I would like to tell women is that when they're apprentices, trust me, it gets better. It really does get better. As an apprentice, I did anyway, and I think that it really holds true for most women. You tend to think that that it's only you, and it's only because we're women, and it's only happening to the women, and this is going to be like this forever. But it's not only happening to the women, and I found that with experience, that it's not just me, and it's not just me, a woman, you know. A lot of the men are going through the very same thing, but they're much more into denial, you know. And so they don't see it, and they don't acknowledge it. I think that they do see it, but they don't acknowledge it. And so in not acknowledging it, they deny it. And in denying it, they become desensitized to what is really going on, you know. That's a lot harder for women to do, for us to disconnect from our feelings on such a deep level. That's why men are in such trouble nowadays, you know. But I think it's important to know that when you finish your apprenticeship, it really does get a lot better. You learn how to deal with the bullshit that the men are laying out, and you learn that a lot of the bullshit that they're putting out is like paper tiger stuff, you know. It's all war and no bite, you know. And it's really a relief, you know, the person that might see, it's really a relief in that way. And I think the other thing is that when I would not recommend someone to get into this or to get into an apprenticeship if they're not willing to seriously take themselves serious as a worker? If you're still at the stage in your life where, because I was at this place too, you know, I'll admit it, I was at a point in my life where I was not coming to work, and I was calling my friend and telling my friend to call up and say that I was sick. I mean, we all go through that period where we just don't want to be responsible for a daggone thing, you know? We party and do this and everything other than what we have to do. If you're at that place, don't bother, because you'll lose it and you won't be able to get back in. Once you lose it with the union, you won't be able to get back in. They'll give you a really hard time getting back in. So when you finish playing and you're really ready to become a worker, then I would say that this is the place to come if you want to make a good living. If you want to make good money, you'll learn how to say fuck you fast.
Thanks, Yvonne. Great talking to you.